remarkably tough, resilient, extraordinary woman. But she is now entering the danger zone. The family have been monitoring her vital signs and in particular her blood glucose levels. And it seems that in the last few days, they have dropped rather alarmingly. And we believe that she may well be approaching the danger zone. At 117 days into a hunger strike without any food, without any calories whatsoever. It's remarkable that she's lasted this long, but she is increasingly frail and everyone is desperately worried for her health. But obviously, the whole point of this, as this hunger strike, as we heard from that clip from her earlier in your introduction, is to precipitate a crisis. She does not want to die. This is not a suicide mission from Leyla. What she wants is to demand justice. She wants to really put Alaa's case at the top of the minds of the Egyptian and the British authorities and make sure that Alaa comes home. So Peter Grusty, she's pretty determined. She's going to stick this out.
We have to leave it there. Peter Grusty, also on hunger strike, Australian journalist in solidarity with Alaa Abdel Fattah, will continue to bring you news of his imprisonment or perhaps his freedom. I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, I'm Karen Wayazi, and this is Supersymmetry. It's like this. You pretend you know my middle name, I'll pretend to like it. So bite my neck, I'll bite my tongue, just shut up and dim the lights. I'm always the villain. Be good for me. Please gulp down your grief and scrub your skin raw. Please crumple up your rage and let me bathe your back and dress you in a new kind of sadness. Please be good to me, if only sometimes. Spell out more apologies between the teeth, weld some new legs to wound again, trade one god for another. Spit glass worms into the grave pool beneath our bed and try not to eat them. Maybe I wanted to give you something you could hold on to. I've been so angry lately. It's not like me. So the pills you made me promise to take? I guess I can't help feeling like something has been stolen from me and I can't stop clawing to get it back. The time stretches between us and I can almost catch it in my mouth. This October, everything tastes like dirt. Another cloud to drown in. Another hemorrhage to wipe up, another wasted year inside of me, this body, some slaughterhouse. But there's no point in asking, no point in being stricken with grief so eager it rots my stomach. Are you still hungry for me? It's like this. You pretend your mother likes me, and I'll pretend I can change.
Come on. You're listening to Close Reads on CFRC 101.9 FM. I'm Corey.
And I'm Madeline.
On Close Reads, we share and analyze creative writing by students here at Queens. Tune in for Close Reads from close by.
Today, we'll be talking about Supersymmetry by Karen Wayasi, which you just heard, and which was followed by Heavy Metal by Cindy Lee. Supersymmetry was published in Collective Reflections, Volume 11. Karen Wayasi is a fifth-year teacher candidate, recent Bachelor of Fine Arts honors graduate, and confessional poetry fan. Her paintings and disjointed ramblings draw from her academic studies on Orientalism and her personal experience navigating Western culture, ideals, and systems as a Chinese woman. I'm going to talk today about the parallel structure that sort of produces a frame narrative around this poem. Here's a quote from the beginning. It's like this. You pretend you know my middle name. I'll pretend to like it. So bite my neck. I'll bite my tongue. Just shut up and dim the lights. It's like this introduces a frame narrative for the rest of the poem and also a specific relationship between the speaker and the addressee that's further developed as we move through the poem a little further. However, as this line progresses, we learn that it's more of a relationship that both the speaker and the addressee have to the speaker. You pretend you know my middle name, I'll pretend to like it. Both agents in this sentence are thinking about the speaker and their name. And in contrast, the addressee is fairly peripheral in this sentence. The speaker's name, the way that their personhood is articulated in language, is fraught both in the context of the relationship between these two figures, and as the addressee doesn't know their name and is pretending otherwise. And it's fraught within the speaker's own relationship to themselves. They too are pretending, falsely representing their relationship to their own subjectivity and its articulation in language. And of course, because a poem is articulation in language, it's an interesting topic to be taking up in written work. Next, the relationship moves from language to the speaker's body. So bite my neck, I'll bite my tongue, just shut up and dim the lights. Again, both the speaker and the addressee are acting on the speaker's body. The addressee bites their neck and the speaker bites their own tongue. This is a very intimate, even sexual image. The addressee and the speaker must be very close to each other for one to bite the other's neck, and the sharpness of the image of teeth on someone's vulnerable neck is both dangerous and quite sensual. The parallel structure breaks off with an M dash, followed by just shut up and dim the lights, which to me reads as one of the characters interrupting the moment that the poetic voice is sort of mulling over, and it's an interruption that's pretty harsh, commanding dialogue. And again, dim the lights feels like they're going to bed together, so it's a fairly intimate situation in which this command is being deployed. And if this situation is an intimate or sexual one, the speaker's resigned, I'll bite my tongue, suggests that they are not an equal partner in this physical encounter or in the relationship more broadly. They're being acted upon by the addressee, but they're silencing themselves rather than being able to act as a subject in turn. The end of the poem returns this frame narrative once more. It's like this. You pretend your mother likes me, and I'll pretend I can change. We move here beyond the specific relationship and encounters between the two characters themselves and introduce a new character, the addressee's mother. And similarly to the examination of the speaker's name, we're thinking again about perception and the speaker in relation to and as understood by other people. Again, the emphasis is on the speaker. They are the one who the mother doesn't like. But as the addressee's pretense allows them to ignore the problem, the onus is on the speaker themselves to change and satisfy the mother, even though they acknowledge immediately that this too is a pretense. They're never going to be able to change and please the addressee's mother. The parallel structure in these various lines draws a parallel between not just the two clauses of each sentence, but between the different moments of comparison. So we can see how the complicated, even unequal relationship between the speaker and the addressee manifests itself in three different situations, but also the parallels between these three situations themselves.
I want to talk about the way that mouths come into this poem and the themes of consumption. Similar to Madeline's discussion of the relationships between the speaker and addressee and how they're really positioned in relation to the speaker rather than more mutually, the mouth, eating, and hunger language broadly follows this pattern too. I'm going to focus my analysis on the first and last columns. Initially, we have bite my neck, I'll bite my tongue. We have an imbalance here with a focus on the speaker. They're the one being bitten and implicitly being harmed, even though both parties are biting. In the fourth column, we have everything tastes like dirt, followed by images of another cloud to drown in, another hemorrhage, another wasted year, all of which are then transferred onto this body, some slaughterhouse. So the taste sets up this idea of the speaker's body itself breaking down and maybe even decomposing. The idea of decomposition is carried forward with grief so eager it rots my stomach. With this line, we see the narrative of consumption progressing with the speaker, focusing on the different steps and sensations of eating. And theirs is really the only perspective where we get these sensations and not just the actions. But also, to our knowledge, the speaker is the only one being damaged. The final note about eating, which is directed towards the addressee, is, are you still hungry for me? So the last idea we're left with in terms of hunger is the addressee's hunger for the speaker. And the speaker's still wanting that hunger, even though we're seeing in the poem the ways that it is damaging them. There's a level of intimacy with the focus on the mouth, but I think the poem also severs the connection between the mouth and language or communication, something it's often associated with lines like shut up and dim the lights, or each set pretending. The figures are not speaking to one another, or at least not telling the truth with their words. Instead, the communication and interactions that we see directly in the poem are moments of eating and being eaten. As a result, the disproportionate impact on the speaker, who is bitten by both figures, whose stomach is rotted by grief, and who the addressee hungers for, really effectively develops that sense of a power imbalance and the impact on and deterioration of the speaker.
Next, we'll be playing Milk by Sweet Trip, followed by an interview with Karen. Was Milk by Sweet Trip. I'm now sitting down with Karen to talk about supersymmetry. Karen, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
It's such a pleasure. First of all, I wanted to talk to you about the process of writing this poem. There's a lot of really vivid imagery, and I wanted to ask in your process if you started with a specific image or a line and maybe worked outwards, or if you started more generally with an idea or a theme and worked inwards.
I started more with an idea, which was to detail my experiences as an asexual woman and as a Chinese woman in various romantic relationships where my boundaries for physical intimacy have been disregarded and even violated by those that I want to love, and allowing that disrespect to happen because my desire to be wanted superseded my respect for myself and my own body. So the poem, it chronicles my loss of my sense of self, my loss of control over my body, the ways that my cultural identity was diminished throughout these relationships, and my body becoming a site of racial and intimate violence. So I'm also a huge fan of confessional poetry. So I was reading a lot of different writers that I admired and having that inspire my process. And in terms of the process, so I started writing it when I was 17. I'm 22 now, but I was freshly out of my first relationship when I was 17, and I wanted to articulate the grief and the anger and put all that angsty 17-year-old melodrama into on paper. And as I made my way through my undergrad, I had been stalked and harassed and followed home and preyed on by a 30-year-old incel and assaulted and violated in a bunch of different ways. And with each experience, I build onto the original poem that I had written when I was 17. So it's like the ship of Theseus mm-hmm. of poems. And I just continued to add lines and images as these experiences changed my sense of self. And so despite having worked on this poem for so long, it's not a polished poem by any means. It's this really ugly, raw, crass Frankenstein of different versions of myself from when I started to write it and to when I finished it, which was last winter.
That's a really amazing concept of like the Frankenstein poem, the poem as something that's being built, something that's still in process, especially because you described like your body as a site, your body as like a location that's kind of, I guess, being Frankenstein in the same way, like the different sort of like temporal moments and different experiences kind of being like suited together on the body, but then also in the poem itself.
Mm-hmm. And I don't consider myself a writer whatsoever. I'm an artist first and foremost. So I think it's okay to make bad art and experiment with doing different kinds of art. I think that this poem isn't great, but I like that I could express myself in words in ways that I don't normally do with my paintings. So
I would push back on the idea that it's bad art. I mean, certainly it is totally fine to make bad art. I don't think that Super Symmetry is bad art. I think it's an incredible poem. And I got like chills when I read it for the first time. And honestly, I still do. Even when I was like writing my analysis for this episode, I was like, I just would have to take a moment every once in a while to just recover, because it really is amazing. But I want to ask something a little bit more technical next. And even though you've claimed you're not a writer, you know, I apologize, but I did want to ask, the poem is largely formatted as a direct address, which I think for readers definitely produces a really like intimate reading experience. And so I wanted to ask you, like from the point of view of the writer, why you chose to format the poem in this way.
So when a relationship ends, there's a lot left unspoken. And for me, at least, there's this huge desire to be confrontational and to tell these people, you've hurt me and this is how much I'm suffering, and I want you to look at how much I'm suffering. But it's also such a childish mindset, and it's not very conducive to healing either. So the direct address in the poem is what I wish I had the courage to say when I could still say it, but without having to actually confront them in real life, I can confront them through this writing. And even now, like thinking, well, I kind of wish that they would read the poem. I kind of wish mm-hmm. they would listen to this radio show, but I know that they never will. And so for me, it's kind of healing in that way.
Mm-hmm. And I like the idea of like something that like as a real life encounter would not actually be productive, becoming productive in a creative sense, mm-hmm. like something that can be maybe more damaging to yourself personally. You can use kind of, I guess, like to fuel the art. In a way that, I guess, like centers yourself as a writer, centering yourself as a subject in a way that maybe like the actual encounter would not actually be able to do.
Mm-hmm. And the formatting of the poem is like these very, very short, stilted lines. Mm-hmm. Almost every line is, I think, 3 syllables. And as the poem progresses, that pattern starts to break as I get a little bit angry and I start to spiral a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I think the stilted speech is really reflective of like these different lines that I was creating from different moments in my life and trying to stitch them together. And that really messy thought process, the stream of consciousness that I was going through and trying to put everything together. So there's like definitely a very stilted rhythm, I think, to the poem as well.
I think it's really funny that you said you weren't a writer and then now you're talking about the like really technical ways that you employed like rhythm and meter and like the line breakup to communicate your message, because it was very effective. Like, I think that it does communicate that kind of and again, like in the form of poetry, it kind of is able to produce meaning in a way that like in an actual conversation it wouldn't be able to, because you don't have those formal features to fall back on. So I wanted to talk about one more aspect of the poem that I particularly adore. I touched on this a little bit already, but I wanted to ask about the "it's like this" frame with which you begin and end the poem. And specifically, because the last stanza is separated out from the rest of the poem, and a friend pointed out to me that the very last word in this poem is change. Why, for you, is this the note on which the poem ends?
So the "it's like this" stanzas in the poem, they act as this bookend. And the bookend is a reference to the title, Supersymmetry. So symmetry in the sense was to play with the idea of romantic compatibility. Mm-hmm. Something symmetrical is the same, but it's also flipped. You're also opposites. And ending the poem in the same way that it was introduced gives us symmetry in the piece and provides two different time frames into the relationship. So the first being the start of this downhole trajectory, and then the end being this bittersweet note of acceptance. But it's not necessarily the kind of acceptance where it's like, well, I'm healed, I'm fixed now, I'm all good, I'm content with myself. It's more of this implicit understanding between two people that either this charade continues or you're going to part ways, and either way it's going to hurt a lot. And so change being the last word wasn't necessarily ending on a hopeful note. It was more of this acceptance that, well, I'm stuck in this body and I can't change it and I can't escape it. It was also it was a Mitski thing. So part of the charade, part of the performance is related to being a racialized person. And Mitski, in her song, Your Best American Girl, she says, your mother wouldn't approve of the way my mother raised me. And so it's a little bit of a reference to that. And that's where the middle name in the first part of the poem, where it's like this, you pretend you know my middle name, that's where that comes from as well. Because I once had this argument with someone where I expressed that I wanted our children to have Chinese names so that they could retain some connection to their culture. And he was white and he didn't understand why that would be important to me whatsoever. We have a very common culture for Chinese people where we have English first names and we keep our Chinese, like our real names, as our middle name. So we're sanitizing our identity to be more palatable to other people. Mm-hmm. And so that in itself is a type of pretense to me. And in that sense, starting the poem with, he can't recognize my culture, he doesn't understand why being Chinese is important to me, and ending the poem with, his mother doesn't like me because I'm not this perfect white woman that she wants me to be, and I can't change that. And now we're just stuck in this limbo of what now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the kind of the conclusion and the kind of acceptance being not an acceptance of an actual like solid conclusion or satisfactory ending, but like the acknowledgement of the pretense, the acknowledgement of the situation being as it is. And it's like, do we go on like this or do we change? That's a really, I think, effective way to end the poem, because it has a sense of conclusion, but it also, like, it does, you have to keep thinking, you know, because there's not actually that sense of ending, even as the poem itself is actually concluding.
And there's, I think we preach a lot of self-love and acceptance and being comfortable in our own skin. Mm-hmm. And then the reality as a woman of color is not feeling safe outside ever, mm-hmm. like in your body ever. And as much as I want to be someone who's like positive and can heal from this, it's every single second of every single day and all of these past experiences that remind me, or at least the me that I was when I was writing this poem, that it seems like so far out of reach and so impossible then.
Yeah. Karen, thank you so much for coming in. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us. This was really amazing, and as I've said, I adore this poem, so I feel very fortunate to be able to talk about it on the radio today. Thank you as well to Audra Krego, who helped me write these interview questions. You can read Supersymmetry by Karen Wayasi in Collective Reflections, Volume 11. This has been Close Reads with Corey and Madeline on CFRC 101.9 FM. To take us out, we'll have That Way Again by Mazzy Star.
He says that he tries to solve his problems as he's bringing me down. I just weep all around. Forgiveness is an empty thought. I find myself
everyone, and welcome back to Melodies of Myth, where we explore short historical tales blended with Indian classical and Western music. I'm your host, Simar Kaur, and it's an honor to accompany you on this journey of discovering the rich interweaving of music and history. Together, we will explore the stories, traditions, and timeless melodies that have shaped our understanding of this art form.
brothers and sisters have died. Over 500 years has washed away our fears and strengthened our pride. Now we turn back the tide. Your control from our lands. Redirect the flame of our anger and pain. And pity the shame for what you do in God's name.
And we will stand for the right to be free. And we will rebuild our own society. And we will sing, we will sing. Of our forefathers saints, the will to live will beat on. We will no longer be pawns to greed and to war. We will be idle no more. And we must stand for the right to be free. And we will rebuild a just society. And we will sing, we will sing. Of our grandmother saints, Native America run. We will no longer succumb to oil and to ore. We will be idle no more. And we must stand for the right to be free. And we will rebuild our own society. And we will sing, we will sing.
What you just heard is a beautiful piece by the legendary Buffy St. Marie titled Sing Our Own Song. This powerful anthem celebrates resilience and unity, calling for indigenous voices to rise and reclaim their stories. With heartfelt lyrics and a timeless melody, it's a testament to Buffy's ability to inspire change and bring people together through her music. Let's dive into a few of her other songs before we move on to our short story of the day. Here are Carry It On and We Are Circling. Enjoy.
circling, circling together. We are singing, singing a heart song. This is family, this is unity, it's a celebration, this is sacred. Spiraling, spiraling together, onward, inward, creature to creation, holy mystery, Mother Earth, childbirth, this is Mother Nature, this is sacred. We are circling, circling together, we are singing. This is celebration, this is sacred. We are spinning, spinning all together. We are singing over the rainbow. This is harmony, this is community. This is celebration, this is sacred. Ripening together, babies, elders, bozos and angels. This is how we grow, this is how we get to know. This is celebration, this is sacred. We are circling, circling together. We are singing. This is celebration, this is sacred.
For today's short story, I thought, why not dive deep into the story of Buffy St. Marie, the artist whose songs you've been enjoying so far. The story of Buffy St. Marie is one of resilience, creativity, and cultural preservation that resonates far beyond Canada's borders. Born on the Pieput 75 Reserve in Saskatchewan in 1941, St. Marie is a Cree singer-songwriter, activist, and educator whose music has been a powerful voice for Indigenous rights and social justice. Her groundbreaking work has left an indelible mark on both Canadian and global music history. It all began in the 1960s when Buffy St. Marie emerged on the folk music scene in New York's Greenwich Village. At a time when civil rights and anti-war movements were gaining momentum, her songs carried a profound message of activism. Tracks like Universal Soldier became anthems for peace, questioning the role of individuals in perpetuating war. The song's raw, honest lyrics resonated with audiences worldwide, pushing St. Marie into the spotlight. What set Buffy apart wasn't just her hauntingly beautiful voice or her talent with instruments like the mouth bow and guitar. It was her ability to infuse her Cree heritage into her music, blending traditional Indigenous sounds with contemporary folk and rock influences. This unique style was showcased in her 1976 album, Sweet America, where songs celebrated indigenous identity and history while addressing systemic injustices. One of her most iconic contributions to music and indigenous representation came in 1969 with Illuminations, an album that broke new ground by incorporating electronic elements, a pioneering move at that time. Saint Marie used the Buchla synthesizer, creating a futuristic soundscape that challenged the folk genre's conventions. Despite its innovation, the album was underappreciated in its time, though it's now recognized as a masterpiece. Buffy's impact extended beyond her music. In the 1970s, she became a regular on Sesame Street, where she taught children about indigenous culture in a way that had never been done before on mainstream television. From breastfeeding her son on air to singing Cree lullabies, Saint Marie shattered stereotypes and normalized indigenous traditions for a global audience. Throughout her career, Saint Marie faced challenges, including industry blacklisting during the 1970s for her outspoken activism. Yet, she persevered. Using her platform to advocate for indigenous sovereignty, environmental justice, and educational reform. Her dedication culminated in the creation of the Cradle Board Teaching Project, which provides indigenous-centered educational resources to schools. Looking back, Buffy St. Marie's influence is immeasurable. Her music has inspired countless artists, from Joni Mitchell to indigenous musicians like Jeremy Dutcher. Her voice, both literal and metaphorical, continues to be a beacon for change, reminding us of the power of art to challenge, heal, and unite. As she once said, "If what I do is beautiful, it's because I've had beautiful things in my life to inspire me." Buffy St. Marie's life and legacy are indeed a testament to that beauty, leaving a lasting mark on the world of music and beyond.
Do you love playing board games? Are you looking for a place on campus to make friends in a relaxed environment? Look no further than Queen's Board Game Club. Join us for weekly Thursday game nights on campus and follow our Instagram at Queen's Board Game Club for more details.
Calling all women in STEM. Are you interested in joining a group that advocates for lifting up women and other underrepresented groups in STEM? Well then, WISE is the place to be. Women in Science and Engineering at Queen's University is a group of passionate women creating welcoming and inclusive spaces for future engineers, scientists, and leaders. When you join WISE, you'll have the opportunity to learn from experienced pros in the field, grow your network, and be a source of inspiration for the young women in the Kingston community. Follow our Instagram at Queen's WISE or visit our website www.queenswise.ca to learn more.
Up next, we have a soul-stirring track that perfectly blends simplicity and emotion. Iktara from the movie Wake Up Sid. Sung beautifully by Kavita Seth and Amitabh Bhattacharya, this song captures the essence of longing, self-discovery, and quiet moments of introspection. With its gentle strumming and poetic lyrics, Iktara is a melody that stays with you long after it ends. So sit back, relax, and let the magic of Iktara take you away.
Thank you. मेरे क्यों दिखाए सपने तू सोते जागते जो पर से सपने बूंद बूंद नैनों को मूंद मूंद
नैनों को बूंद बूंद
जो पर से सपने बूंद बूंद नैनों को मूंद मूंद कैसे मैं चलूं देख ना सकूं अनजाने रास्ते
जैसा है कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा दी मैं बोले कोई एक तारा दी मैं बोले कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा
अपने बूंद बूंद नैनों को मूंद मूंद
नैनों को मूंद मूंद
जो बरसे सपने बूंद बूंद नैनों को मूंद मूंद कैसे मैं चलूं देख ना सकूं अनजाने रास्ते
जैसा है कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा दी मैं बोले कोई एक तारा दी मैं बोले कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा तू जैसा है कोई एक तारा
Wasn't that just magical? Up next, we have an instrumental rendition that beautifully captures the essence of love and longing. Here is Samjhava violin cover from the movie Humti Sharma Ki Dulhaniya, originally sung by the mesmerizing voices of Arijit Singh and Shreya Ghoshal, and brought to life on the silver screen by actors Varun Dhawan and Alia Bhatt. This particular cover by the talented Mithun Murali takes you on an emotional journey with every heartfelt note. So, sit back, relax, and let the melody enchant you.
Main jeena tere baaton mein jeena re jeena 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 main jeena tere baaton mein jeena re je
And with that song, our time together today comes to an end. I hope you enjoyed, and I also hope to see you here next Friday at 1:30 p.m. at Melodies of Myth at CFRC 101.9 FM.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
KPP Concerts and CFRC 101.9 FM present a stacked lineup of shows this January and February at the Broom Factory, featuring a mix of big-name acts and some local favorites. On January 18th, don't miss Canadian alt-rock duo Mountainhead. January 24th features local indie rock outfit Cassador. On January 26th, Bedouin Soundclash takes the stage. February 7th sees Busty and the Bass come to town. And on February 19th, it's a special Wednesday night rock show with headliners Dear Rouge. For additional information and to buy tickets, visit kppconcerts.com.
Yes, I'd like a bowl of hot alphabet soup.
Hi, my name is Hayden, and I have a new show on CFRC called Alphabet Soup.
A bowl of hot?
Make sure it's hot.
Alphabet Soup is a musical variety show that's live every Tuesday from 10 to 11 a.m.
Make sure it's hot.
Right.
Okay, sir. Coming right up.
Tune in to hear something classic or something fresh. Tuesdays at 10 a.m. on CFRC.
Hey, Charlie, table 26 wants a hot alphabet soup.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
This ain't Monkey Wrench by Foo Fighters. This isn't actually an ad for my new show. You want to join me, Zach, every Saturday at 8 p.m. for your favorite 90s hits, throwbacks, and deep cuts. We'll be playing you songs like this all night from 8 to 9 p.m. So join me as I take you to the 90s.